Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are joined by a man who unfortunately is a little under the weather, but he has nonetheless risen to the challenge of providing his expert insights and commentary on the great challenge of our time. That would be, of course, what our friend Jim Fennell calls the main thing. The Chinese Communist Party, the threat that it poses to our country, and what we need to do about it. As it happens, Dr. Bradley Thayer contributed to a very important webinar touching on many aspects of this subject just yesterday, one of our series of Committee on the Present Danger China webinars. He is a member of that committee, as well as a very important member of our staff at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs our China program. Brad Thayer is also the author, with Liang Chao Han, of an important new book, Understanding the China Threat, which he certainly does, and a book that I think is really required reading for all of us at a moment such as this. Dr. Thayer, I am sorry that you have been afflicted by the Wuhan virus, apparently, but thank you for joining us nonetheless to push back against the CCP that's perpetrated this on you, among many, many others of us.
Welcome. Frank, it's a great pleasure to join you today, and thank you for your best wishes. Suffering as so many millions have around the world as a result of the perfidy of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, well, and the complicity of their friends in enabling that to become a real blight on so many, to the effect that, you know, millions of them have died, no less. Brad, we trust that will not be your fate at this moment. You look as though you're more or less managing it, and I hope that you've got your ivermectin and your hydroxychloroquine at hand, as they're highly recommended in this circumstance. But let me talk to you a little bit about the webinar. The subject was, we called it "Let's Give Xi Something to Worry About," because he's evidently in a worrying mind at the moment. And that's partly because of internal circumstances and partly because, as our colleague Steve Mosier laid out brilliantly, this is kind of what aging tyrants do in their latter years, react paranoidically to uncertainty and a sense of disloyalty all around. Let's start by talking a little bit about the internal problems that the Chinese Communist Party is facing at the moment.
Well, Frank, their central problem is that they're communists. And so with communism comes a coterie of innumerable problems, difficulties, human rights abuses, the willingness to kill people for odious ends. And so when we look at the CCP, we recognize, first of all, that is where they went wrong by being put in power by the Soviet Union and the Comintern in the 30s, 40s, ultimately 1949. But Xi's facing, of course, and Mao was just as reckless, of course. One thing that we want to recognize is whether young or old, communist regimes are dangerous and very aggressive. So, and Xi sees himself, of course, as the new Mao, sees himself completely in that model, and even to move beyond Mao Zedong as the greatest Chinese communist leader in that pandemonium, of course, obviously of horrible individuals. So his problems are social, his problems are economic, his problems are demographic. Those are problems of China and the state that the Chinese Communist Party has brought that great country to at this point of time. His problem is also the party, in that he's been so ruthless in purging it, as we saw at the 20th Party Congress in 2022, where he had Hu Jintao, his predecessor, escorted out. He's been purging the leadership of the military, the foreign minister, of course, the defense minister, and it's not going to end as the paranoia increases. And of course, with that, there'll be a greater ratio of purges. This is a very precarious time for Taiwan, because he's going to be thinking, of course, that a way to get out of this a situation is to aggress, to achieve the conquest of Taiwan, and thus accomplish something Mao Zedong did not do, although Mao desperately wanted to, in the 40s, of course, in 1950s.
Yeah. Well, you're so right to make the point that communists are inherently dangerous and inherently aggressive. It seems as though, as again, Steve Mosher documented in a very interesting sort of history of going back, I guess, to Imperial China, for that matter, not to just focus on the Chinese communists, but especially Mao, how in their latter years, these guys become downright, unpredictably ruthless, as opposed to the predictable kind. And that certainly translates into greater danger, as you say, for Taiwan, and I would argue for us, but also for the Chinese people. And one of the things that you've been focused on intensively, Brad, is the common cause that oppression of the Chinese people presents as an opportunity for us to help bring down the regime that so brutally oppresses them and threatens us. Talk a little bit about your thinking on that subject, Brad. What measures, what techniques, what technologies might be brought to bear to actually help the Chinese people bring down the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, from our perspective, the great virtue of the Chinese Communist Party is that it is attempting to impose a Western import, a communism, on a great civilization, with its own Chinese civilization, with its own history, with its own, of course, conceptions of political philosophy and polity. Communism is at variance with all of that. And so it would be as if Taoism were attempted to be imposed on the United States, right? We have no tradition of Taoism whatsoever in the U.S., and it would be rightfully seen as a foreign entity. Communism, of course, is far worse than Taoism, but it is a Western entity. So the vulnerability is what he himself has introduced through this ideology and his argument that it's only through communism that China can be great, which, of course, is absurd. China was great in the past, and it will be in the future, of course, once again, when it's freed itself from communism. The Chinese people recognize this. They know this, and this is why they loathe the Chinese Communist Party, even though it approximately has 99 million members in China, right, in a population of 1.4. That's telling by the number of people who have not joined, and, of course, so many joined just for reasons of career. And family connections, etc. So we have a fundamental vulnerability that we can exploit if we can get a way to break down the Great Firewall, if we can get the Chinese people to have access to, if you will, the global internet and the ability to communicate without fear of being caught in what the People's Republic of China is, which is a surveillance superpower, right? This is because it knows it's illegitimate, it watches its population very closely, and both in a physical sense, but also, of course, if you will, in an online presence. And the social credit score, Frank, which you have stressed many times, of course, on these broadcasts, is one of those tools that they use to coerce their population.
You know, interestingly enough, this was a theme, Brad, of the show yesterday, in that the point was made, I think, by several of you, that the priority assigned to controlling the people of China is evidence of, the weakness of the regime, and therefore the opportunity that might be advanced to bring it down with the people's help. We have a lot more to talk about with Brad Thayer on the other side of a very short break. He seems to be holding up reasonably well. We're appreciative of that. We'll be right back with more right after this. This This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If addicts are blessed or simply lucky, people who love them will organize a life-saving intervention. Our informal Save America's Military Coalition intervened yesterday to expose and help counter the effects of toxic Marxist Kool-Aid many in our armed forces have gotten hooked on by the three Obama-Biden administrations. 20 prominent veterans and other patriots conducted a telethon, originally intended to encourage the U.S. Senate to understand and address the damage being done to the military's readiness, morale, and deterrence capabilities by so-called woke officers like General C.Q. Brown, the recently confirmed incoming Joint Chiefs Chairman. It turns out the Senate itself needs an intervention. All other things being equal, senators seem likely to agree to the promotions of other champions of cultural Marxist divide-and-conquer strategies like critical race theory and diversity, equity, inclusion. Join us in intervening at SaveAmericasMilitary.org. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. Dr. Bradley Thayer is in the house, a little under the weather, but we're very appreciative of his time and his, insights, as always, notwithstanding a bit of COVID. Brad, I wanted to pivot to something that even the New York Times has taken note of recently, and that is that the South China Sea has become a very dangerous place as a result of what the Chinese Communist Party has been up to. Well, for a decade or more now, building out bastions from which they can not only project power, but very ruthlessly oppress, well, not only the people of China, as we were talking about, but neighbors in that area. That vast area, by the way, through which, as you know so well, passes $1 trillion of commodities and other products, I think, with great regularity, at least it has to this point. Talk a little bit about this article in the New York Times, if you would, and more generally, what we are to make of the Chinese assertion of dominion over those waters, the air above them, and the resources below.
Well, it's an ambition of the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party in control of the PRC to dominate the South China Sea. Mao Zedong attempted this, initiated really with his 1974 invasion of the Paracel Islands, conquering basically half of those from South Vietnam. And then in 88, China again aggressed against Vietnam at Fiery Cross. More recently, 95, at Mischief Reef, 2012 at Scarborough Shoal, and right now at Second Thomas Shoal, we're witnessing the PRC's efforts to dominate the Philippines and to force the Filipinos to yield to China's demands. And thankfully, the Filipinos are very brave in this regard and are resisting that. They could use more help from the U.S. and from other actors, but nonetheless, the Filipinos are resisting this very importantly.
I want to come back to that point about the U.S. That's crucial, of course. But when you talk about what the Chinese are doing to try to dominate the Filipinos, what are you looking at in that regard? It seems as though it's being ratcheted up quite dramatically of late.
It is. We see naked aggression with the PRC's actions against the Philippines. After 2012, where the PRC took Scarborough Shoal, and the Obama administration, to its great shame, did nothing to back up the Filipinos at that time.
Well, in fact, if I understand it correctly, they had thought they brokered some sort of understanding that both sides would sort of back away. The Chinese, of course, didn't honor their commitments. Is that right?
And the Filipinos took the Chinese PRC to the Permanent Court of Arbitration, where the PCA found in favor of the Philippines. And PRC responded with something out of the Melian Dialogue from Thucydides, Peloponnesian War: the strong do what they will and the weak endure what they must, especially if the weak are not backed by a greater power, that is the United States. So we see this naked aggression, the willingness to violate international laws. We saw in Hong Kong as well, as we see on a regular basis. The PRC is making a new status quo, which is PRC dominance of the South China Sea, as well as East China Sea too, because the ambition is not only limited, maritime ambitions, of course, are not just limited to South China Sea, but East China Sea and beyond. Yeah. So
that new status quo, though, just to be precise, not only involves the daily penetration of Taiwanese airspace and the operation of these bastions, I call them, now dotting the South China Sea, which have been massively built out. These are little atolls, mostly underwater, as I understand it, most of the time, but they nonetheless have dredged them. They've built them up. They've put 10,000 foot runways on them. They've put, naval facilities. They've put armaments of all different kinds, from which they are now projecting power and staking claims. But just to come back to the Philippines in particular, the new normal that they seem to be trying to develop is, I understand that they actually built some kind of blockade arrangement with buoys and you know, putting their militia ships and fishing vessels and the like in the way of the Filipinos, well, access to their own waters or some of these atolls. This seems deliberately provocative. And, you know, we've long been talking, Brad, at the Committee on the Present Danger China, that we may not necessarily face in the first instance an act of aggression or even an invasion of Taiwan. It may be that they vector it towards the Filipinos or others in the region. So what's your current assessment of how well this stacks up in terms of that kind of aggression?
Well, the United States, working with its allies and partners like Taiwan and Vietnam, can roll them back. That is, we can eject the PRC from the South China Sea if we stand together and in a concerted effort coerce them out of these facts on the ground, Frank. As you well know from law, possession is 9/10, right? And so what are they doing? They're making accomplished facts by building these places. Well, we need to isolate them and eject them. From that, standing with the Filipinos, the Vietnamese, Malaysians, with Brunei, Indonesia, other states as well, to roll them back and not accept the status quo that they're attempting to establish, but to recognize what was identified by international law, which is the South China Sea is nobody's territory. It is essentially, open to navigation for all parties, free and fair navigation for all parties. And that is the time to stand with it. Your point that we've been looking at Taiwan rightfully because this is precarious, but it may be the Philippines where they aggress first. And we have new bases in the Philippines, which is very important, at least four bases in the Philippines. And so it is very important that the Biden administration, it's often said that a stop clock is right twice a day. And let's hope the Biden administration, like a stop clock, can get this one right and can stand with the Filipinos.
Well, you know, Kamala Harris, the vice president, made a very bold statement recently to the effect that, interference by the Chinese with not just the military assets of the Philippines, but public conveyances of various kinds and what have you, will cause us to invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty. Now, the Chinese have begun using water cannons and threatening to ram and otherwise, as I say, putting these blockades. It seems as though we're quite close to this. And I know that, Brad, some listening to this conversation, whether it's about, engaging the Chinese people to try to bring down the regime that brutalizes them and, as I say, threatens us, or this conversation about, possibly going to war over some incident with the Chinese aggressing against the Philippines, that, this is very, belligerent talk and we mustn't engage in it. One of the takeaways from our webinar yesterday, and again, folks, please check this out at presentdangerchina.org. The whole series of now well over 110 of these webinars is available for free, and I commend it to you in the strongest of terms, particularly this one in which Brad Thayer has participated as he often does. But Brad, the bottom line is, it seems as though we're in a race with these guys as to who will take the other out first. And that's not a happy situation, but I think history teaches, and I give you 30 seconds to respond to this, that taking action earlier is better than trying to take it later.
Indeed, Frank, this problem was decades in the making, just as the problem that we face from the PRC threat was decades in the making, and year after year, we did nothing about it. And so we're incurring the cost of that negligence. However, these bases are supremely vulnerable. Building an island in the middle of the South China Sea isolates you terribly. You're not going to drive to it. You're going to have to sail to it or fly to it. And those are our strengths.
And that's where, at least they have been historically. Brad Thayer, we have to leave it at that. Come back to us soon, my friend, if you would, and feel better. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm super excited to have with us our next guest. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. She is no stranger to this program. In fact, she's one of our duty experts on something she properly describes as the culture of the U.S. military and how it is being endangered by something that is euphemistically described as wokeism. And we're going to get to the ground truth about what is in fact going on inside the ranks at the moment and to what end with a woman who founded and runs a terrific organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has served on both departmental and presidential commissions over a distinguished career as an expert on the inadvisability of social engineering of our military in any number of ways. And we value enormously her insights and expertise, and we're so glad to have her back. Thank you, Elaine, for joining us once again.
Good morning, Frank.
Good day. Let me start by asking you about this term, woke. I personally believe a deliberate deflection, a misleading term that really conceals what's going on is cultural Marxism. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's a word that conservatives certainly did not invent. It has kind of an urban background where it came from. When I first heard it, I thought, what the heck is that?
I'm told it actually came from Mao, if I'm not mistaken, but
well, you know more about it than I do.
There are others who use it, that's for sure.
The teachings of critical race theory, diversity, equity, inclusion. I noticed the more I looked at people like Ibram Kendi and what they were teaching, that what they are doing is advocating for extremism in various areas of public policy with coercion, imposed with coercion, in a way that harms the institution. Now, that's where I think there's a parallel, between the cultural Marxism and what is called woke. Woke used to be called political correctness, but political correctness isn't intense enough. It doesn't imply coercion. It doesn't imply hurting an institution. It was relatively harmless compared to what we see now as woke, what is being imposed at the Pentagon. Regardless of what you call it, it hurts the institution. And it applies to not just one issue or a set of issues. It's not just about sexuality or the transgender issue or things like that. It covers things such as environmentalism, ESG mandates that harm corporations, limitations on gas emissions. All of these things hurt the institution, and they're imposed with coercion, government coercion. And this government, this administration, has excelled beyond anyone's expectations, including far leftists who may be in other countries and watching with great interest, the dismantling of so many institutions in our nation. And of course, I look closely at what is happening to the military.
Right. But well, let's drill down on that.
It's a very coercive force, and it's very powerful.
Yeah, no, you've made that point, and I think you're absolutely right to emphasize it, because the insidiousness as well as the subversiveness of it is hard to overstate. So, Elaine, when you talk about things like critical race theory or diversity, equity, and inclusion, can you discuss a little bit of how they're being coercively foisted upon the men and women in uniform at the moment?
Well, It's very, you talk about being subversive, or how it sneaks in without really knowing. It usually comes in under harmless sounding words like diversity and inclusion, equity. But what you see is a class warfare being encouraged, where you have one group of people who are regarded as oppressors and others who are the people who are being oppressed. It is extremely
divisive. Class or is it race?
It's basically race. It is a racial thing. It has to do with your skin color. Right. This is why whiteness is attacked in ways that, I mean, when you see it the first couple of times, it is so concerning. Wait a minute. What are you talking about? Whiteness is evil, and whiteness hurts other people because of their skin color. Yeah. We don't
inherently
have
supremacist
this kind of systemic policy. We don't.
Yeah.
And yet,
especially in the military.
Kids. Especially in the military. And it is being taught at West Point and all the service academies. And people advocate for it, and they're very high level people. And many of them are being promoted right now as officers at very highest levels. And it's very concerning. Now, parents who become aware of this in the Department of Defense schools, they don't have any rights, except if Congress intervenes. There is a Parents' Rights Amendment in the pending National Defense Authorization Act. And guess who's opposed to it? Every LGBT left activist, every 155 members of Congress signed a letter attacking that provision and a few others that I'll discuss in a few minutes, having to do with the transgender treatments for adults and children across state lines. So the lines are here. The battle lines are very obvious. I have an article coming out today or tomorrow that describes or explains why the conflict between Senator Tuberville and the Pentagon, which has really gotten nasty. The attacks on Senator Tuberville have been unprecedented. This is not just about abortion. It's about the full agenda of transgender treatments funded by the Department of Defense across state line and benefiting big funders who make a lot of money off of this kind of philosophy. Well, it's quite frightening when you see at the service academies, Department of Defense schools, little kids being taught to look at others based on their race, their skin color. Same thing at the service academies, people being divided instead of united as a fighting force. When you see this happening, when 155 members of Congress are targeting principles in the or provisions in the defense bill that's pending that would protect parents' rights, that would eliminate critical race theory from instructions, that would go after diversity, equity, inclusion mandates and advocate for meritocracy instead. The left is really alarmed about the provisions in this defense bill. And that's why the conservatives have to unite and get those good provisions through. Even if the president resists, because there will be other elections coming. These are all election issues, and our military is very much at risk.
And I just want to make that point that it's not just the schools, it's not just the academies, it's in the ranks as well where this indoctrination is taking place. And to come back to your earlier point, to coerce people into conformity, we've not only had purges, some involving the vaccine mandates, but
yes,
others involving ideology pretty explicitly. Elaine, but we've also had, I think it's fair to say, the, you know, commissars that have been insinuated for diversity, equity, and inclusion, that are now part of this means of sort of jamming all of it down the throats of our men and women in uniform.
Yes, the Air Force specializes in this.
Yeah, well,
chief diversity officers and purple ropes, indicating that the political officer is present with the purple rope. Everybody gets the idea, gets the message. You either comply and you go along with this and you say how great it is, you're not going to be promoted if you don't. And people have families and their futures at risk. I understand how that works. That's why I formed CMR 30 years ago, because I realized I don't speak for military people, but I do know that their voices are not being heard. And that's why you and have done this too. These policies affect people, men and women in the military. They are not the problem. The problem is the leadership that is imposing these policies, even if it hurts the institution.
And I just wanted to say, you mentioned the Air Force as an extreme example of this, both at the Air Force Academy and I think in the service more generally. And that has happened on the watch of General C.Q. Brown.
That's right.
Who, despite our best efforts, has just been confirmed by the Senate to become the next top military officer in the country, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
That's right.
I just wanted to say, you talked a little bit about Senator Tuberville. He deserves our heartfelt thanks and strong support for having not only put a hold on a whole bunch of these promotable flag officers and general officers, but also giving us all an opportunity to assess the extent to which many of these folks really embrace. They're not just going along with the program to get promoted, I don't think. I think some of them, certainly General Brown, are committed to this cultural Marxist agenda and the takedown of the military that is inevitable as a result.
Well, Senator Tuberville voted against General Brown. He and 10 other Republicans. I've put out the list of those 11. There should have been more, because this is the chief advisor to the President of the United States. He does not make policy, but certainly what he says carries a lot of weight. And what he says is totally reflective of the of an attitude of racial division, unfortunately. And I don't know how much more our military can take of this. With regard to Tuberville, the whole issue is supposedly about access to abortion across state lines so that military women can get to states where abortion is legal. Right behind this push, there's more to it than meets the eye, because the transgender movement, the people who want government Defense Department funding, not only for travel and subsidies and time off, but very expensive lifelong subsidies, not just for adults, but for children, to get the kinds of treatments that are extremely controversial. They are right behind the abortion issue. Now, if the precedent is set that the Department of Defense Secretary Austin can make policy on his own, it's not going to stop there.
Yeah.
That's only the beginning.
No, that's the point. And we're going to come back to it in just a moment. Elaine Donnelly is with us from the Center for Military Readiness. You need to go to cmrlink.org for all of her great work. We'll be right back with more of it right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If addicts are blessed or simply lucky, people who love them will organize a life-saving intervention. Our informal Save America's Military Coalition intervened yesterday to expose and help counter the effects of toxic Marxist Kool-Aid many in our armed forces have gotten hooked on by the three Obama-Biden administrations. 20 prominent veterans and other patriots conducted a telethon, originally intended to encourage the U.S. Senate to understand and address the damage being done to the military's readiness, morale, and deterrence capabilities by so-called woke officers like General C.Q. Brown, the recently confirmed incoming Joint Chiefs Chairman. It turns out the Senate itself needs an intervention. All other things being equal, senators seem likely to agree to the promotions of other champions of cultural Marxist divide-and-conquer strategies like critical race theory and diversity, equity, inclusion. Join us in intervening at SaveAmericasMilitary.org. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are continuing our very important conversation with Elaine Donnelly, one of our duty experts on the culture of the U.S. military and what is being done that is incredibly harmful to it and therefore to the national security of the United States and the well-being, I believe, of every American. Elaine, I did want to just capture a thought because it's, I think, something that is implicit in what we've been talking about, but it's not perhaps as explicit as it should be. And that is, by and large, these are innovations, shall we call them, in the United States military, whether it is putting in quotas on the basis of racial preferences instead of having a meritocracy based on performance, particularly combat performance, that are antithetical to the traditions of the military and as you've indicated, harmful to the good order and discipline, the unit cohesion, the readiness of our forces, and ultimately their deterrent capabilities. We're, I believe, at an extremely perilous time, as we were just talking about with Brad Thayer. The Chinese Communist Party is on a war footing, and we may well find ourselves in a shooting war here very shortly. This would seem to me to be no time to be taking liberties with what has proven essential to our forces' capabilities in the past and almost certainly will in the future. Your thoughts?
And you know what else is happening, Frank? Not only are these things happening, people who are doing them are denying what they are doing. Just yesterday, Senator Tuberville was quoted and attacked for saying the military is not an equal opportunity employer. It is not, and it should not be. And as if you listen to his statement, he's saying that we want the best, it's meritocracy. And the critics of the senator who want to bring him down no matter what, they say, oh, well, he is repudiating the principles of President Harry Truman. It's just the opposite. He is trying to uphold meritocracy, non-discrimination. This is what we favor. But the people who are pushing equity quotas deliberately discriminate. The Air Force announced they were going to reduce the percentage of white males from 80% to 67.5%. Now, the only way you can do that, of course, is by discriminating against people because of their skin color. And they're quite open about it, even as they, oh no, we don't have quotas, they deny it. It's absolutely ridiculous. But the Orwellian way that the senator is being attacked, and I'm so pleased to see that he is standing up, others can learn lessons from that. You can't compromise with people who are not interested in being reasonable. They are extreme. They want to impose their extremism on the military with coercion, even if it hurts the institution. And that's what's going on.
Elaine, the other piece of it, and we just can't say it often enough, the other piece of it is their extremism is Marxism. Marxism is a hostile ideology, and when it is applied to our institutions, and it's all of them, it's not just the military, it's just particularly dangerous when it's applied to the military, is for the purpose of taking it down. I mean, the Chinese communists and other enemies of this country, I think, are ecstatic about what they see being done at our own hands to our most important institutions and really the fundamental pillars of our government.
It truly is frightening. I think some members, many actually, more than I've seen before, members of Congress do understand this. That's why the House bill, especially defense bill, has so many good provisions in it. The Senate attempted and did not have all the votes needed, but they did pass a meritocracy amendment with the help of Joe Manchin, of all people. We don't know what's going to happen in the conference committee. I certainly hope the Republicans get through it without losing a lot of these good amendments. But there's so many forces. There's the government spending, and what is the budget going to be? What will the policy be with regard to Ukraine? All of these things are all mixed in, and we're watching with alarm and concern, but also trying to encourage those who are doing the right thing to continue on. I'll just mention a few. Representative Ralph Norman successfully sponsored an amendment to stop Exceptional Family Member Program, that's for kids, EFMP program funds for transgender treatments across state lines. Now, that is one of two amendments targeted by these 155 who's who liberal members of Congress. They don't want that because the DOD is already doing this. It's wrong, and they know it's wrong, and they don't want people to know. That's why I wrote about the article. That's why I wrote the article that will be published today. Let's put the spotlight on it. We have an amendment from Matt Rosendale to cut off TRICARE coverage for these very controversial treatments and surgeries, even on children in the military.
Transgender.
Exactly. And if his amendment is stripped out, the Pentagon, the same Secretary of Defense who got away with making his own policy on abortion subsidies, he's going to do the same thing on the transgender demands. And you know why? Because these transgender groups meet at the Pentagon at a very high level all the time. They even publish printouts of their meetings with Human Rights Campaign, groups like that. They are totally together. And this is the kind of administration that we're seeing, and we need a new president.
Yeah. Well, and I think the point about the law is that Senator Tuberville feels, and I think he's right, that even when the law prohibits abortion funding.
Exactly.
From the Defense Department, these guys are doing it. So yes, you can imagine if there is no such prohibition, or if the prohibition was offered and then blocked in the Congress, they'll be off to the races to do all of this and more. Elaine, we have to take another very short break, but when we come back, I want to visit with you about a program that you're going to be participating in that, as we speak, we're doing later today. We're calling it a telethon to try to raise further awareness in the Congress. You say there is some evidence that people are becoming clued up about this Marxist takedown of our military. We want to make sure they're not only clued up, but they're acting on it with the National Defense Authorization Act provisions, yes, but also with respect to promotions of others who, like General C.Q. Brown, are all in on this idea that the woke agenda, a cultural Marxist takedown of the military, is just what we need to be doing. We'll be right back to talk about that and much more with Elaine Donnelly, the founder and president of a marvelous organization, the Center for Military Readiness. Stay tuned. We're back. We are continuing and about to conclude this very, very timely conversation with one of our country's real leaders on the issues of supporting the military, which, as she points out, really does not have a voice in the public policy debate. That's part of the discipline under which the military, historically an apolitical military, has operated. And Elaine, you speak, powerfully about these issues, and I think you do so on behalf of our men and women in uniform, and I couldn't appreciate it more. We're going to be having your help in a very interesting program we're doing today with an array of national security practitioners and other public policy experts and grassroots activists and thought leaders under the banner of an informal pickup team we're calling the Save America's Military Coalition. And if people want to register to see it or otherwise take aboard the work of this team, please go to saveamericasmilitary.org. And Elaine, I just wanted to say the kinds of things that you've been addressing for years now about this social engineering or trying to fundamentally transform, to use Barack Obama's phrase, the United States military, has been so vital. And one of the things you've warned about previously, and I know just now as well, is what they're doing at the moment is bad enough, but what they intend to slipstream behind it, if they get away with it, is even worse. Talk a little bit about, for example, the Gays in the Military initiative, or the Women in Combat initially in places like, airplane cockpits, and how these things have inexorably, metastasized in ways that have been really harmful to the military.
Frank, you were there. We all worked very hard in 2010 against repeal of the law regarding gays in the military. And among the issues that we raised was that repeal of that law would create a new law, LGBT law, and it would include transgender rights. Well, of course, the administration at that time denied it. They knew better. We knew better. And sure enough, after the law was repealed, the Obama administration began laying the groundwork for transgenders in the military. And that is what they got. And Donald Trump came along and decided to change that policy. There was a study done, and it found that medical expenses for these people who were identified with gender dysphoria rocketed up 300%. And in some cases, travel for getting special treatments, it cut into maintenance accounts and other very important funds. And that's what it was under the Obama administration. Trump changed that. Now Biden has taken it to even more extremes. The problem here is with the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General C.Q. Brown, there were two senators who asked him specific questions about this transgender policy. And we have a new article on our webpage right now about gender, about General Brown. We just posted it yesterday. And guess what he said when he was asked about things like, well, when women are confronted by biological, physically intact males in showers, are you in favor of that? In essence, he said, well, we will look at it and we'll try to do something. And he just danced around the question.
Don't want people to be uncomfortable, I think, was the term.
Yeah, we don't want people to be uncomfortable, even though, I mean, another question was, how is a woman in the shower supposed to know that the man approaching her in the altogether has had his gender marker changed? And even if he did, what difference would it make? You see, biology and ideology are in a total clash here. And he either doesn't get it, or he just flat out doesn't want to admit it. Then he was asked about the Supreme Court of the United States, the decision having to do with racial preferences. And all he said was, well, it's my understanding that the court, the opinion does not apply to the military service academies. That is true. But he missed the opportunity to answer the follow-up question. Do you want those racial discrimination policies to continue, or will you end them? Instead, he talked about fairness. Yeah. Fairness in admissions, not
and
the
diversity.
Same as equality.
He's all in on diversity.
So and right Elaine, there, he's flunked that test.
Yeah,
and that was a reason enough alone not to vote for his nomination.
If you're looking for reasons not to vote for his nomination, one might be that he actually materially harmed the strength and readiness of our Air Force, and
yes,
the idea that he might be now setting about to do the rest of the services the same disfavor, I think is just horrifying. But let me just ask you one question, because this is an issue on which I know you have worked mightily and over a long period of time. There have been, with the introductions of large numbers of women into the ranks, including in combat positions, frontline positions, a growing number of incidences of sexual misconduct and rape and other, crimes. And they've gone through great gyrations about trying to figure out command arrangements and reporting and all the rest of it to try to contend with this problem. Elaine Donnelly, I can't for the life of me figure out what they think is going to happen when you put physically intact males who identify as females in the bedrooms and in the showers with women. Do you think that might result in some problems in this
country? I think it will. And the Pentagon right now, their policy is not to report on problems with the transgender policy. It's right there in their official documents. We analyzed this last, February, March. And let's use a new term. It was someone else who invented it, but I really like the term. Synthetic sexual identities. Okay, if someone in their mind believes they are a woman, they have a psychological condition. But everybody else is supposed to buy into the synthetic sexual identity, or SSI, that the Pentagon has bought into. Now, this causes
buying into it is
problems.
One thing, but effectively enforcing conditions that are conducive to more.
And you've got to have synthetic pronouns to go with this, synthetic pronouns that
themself,
deny
no less
themselves. There was a bit of a dust up about whether General Milley retiring would get them. Themself distinguished themselves, something ridiculous. And Senator Tom Cotton did a brilliant job of making fun of it. And they said, we're not going to do that.
I wish we were seeing more of Tom Cotton on all of this at the moment.
Yes.
That's another subject for another day. We'll look forward to talking with you about that soon. Thank you, Elaine Donnelly, for your time today.
Thank
God
you.
Bless the work you do at the Center for Military Readiness. Come back soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.